I'm Andrew Edwards, and I'd like to thank, this was actually in my speech, so don't, yeah. I'd like to thank Claire Phillips, Chris, Jeremy, Becky Orr, and everyone else for helping bring this group together, and all of you for assembling to discuss the conjunctures and disjunctures marking the dawn of the modern era. So I'm an Americanist, mostly, by training. But at Oxford, I've been working in conversation with Chris, with Peter, and other colleagues in the Global History of Capitalism Project and the Political Economy and Culture and Global History workshop, on the historical construction of capitalism's basic categories, like the subject of my talk today, the commodity. So my talk is entitled, The Spaces in Between, What is Global About the History of Capitalism? Notes Towards the History of the Commodity. So the history of the commodity, as we all know, is a history of goods for sale. More particularly, in recent work, it has been the history of goods intended for mass consumption. At their best, histories of goods, from textiles to tea, uncover the human relations that seemingly impersonal flows of commodities conceal, tracking them from the point of production through processing, marketing, and sales. These histories remind us that commodities do not act for themselves, even if they sometimes seem to. In exposing these relations, historians are fighting against a persistent myth, the idea of all commodities as the impersonal embodiments of what, of, in Adam Smith's terms, later appropriated by David Ricardo and Karl Marx, value in use and value in exchange. Or more simply, a good with a price. Like these above the trading pits in the old Chicago Board of Trade, circa 1948, or more closely related to today's talk and our location, the prices of large oxen in London's Smithfield Market in August 1707. So at the same time, historians wrestle with the fact, from the perspective of economic history, as recently argued by Kevin O'Rourke, that commodities in their simplified form offer a window on global history with few viable alternatives, providing the basis for studies showing how prices converge as global market links become more efficient, for example, as well as a means to establish and compare the purchasing power of workers' daily wages historically on a global scale. But a historian, like any laborer, perhaps, is no better than their tools. And if these tools are concepts, like the commodity, they should not pass unexamined. We must consider that what many historians view of material culture view as the myth of the commodity, its impersonality, stripped of extra economic values and associations, like all myths, perhaps, has a basis in history. So today I want to consider the possibilities for exploring the history of the commodity as a category in capitalism that has changed over time, and link that examination with an appraisal of the significance of the global in the history of capitalism. So in order to tell that history, we need to reimagine, I would argue, the commodity itself, considering it as an object of what Lorraine Dasein has called historical epistemology, less as goods themselves than as a way of interpreting and understanding goods. That, I will argue, arose out of what I'll refer to in my title as the spaces in between, global encounters and exchange. So the Anglo-American specificity of my account is deliberate, but I hope not fatal. The primary danger of Eurocentrism, as Cedric Robinson has argued, is to mistake for universal verities the structures and dynamics of Europe's own distant and more immediate pasts. That I hope to have avoided here. The goal is to contribute, in Marshall Solons' words, to a global history of capitalism attesting to the authenticity of other modes of existence, in part by denaturalizing our own. So today I want to do three things. First, I want to present the notion of the commodity as a way of knowing by showing it in action in 17th century Britain and its Atlantic periphery, suggesting that this peripheral global experience was crucial to the commodity's epistemological development. Second, I want to suggest how the commodity transformed after being embedded in British political economy and emerging by the 18th century as a kind of moral economy of knowing within the British Empire. And finally, I want to suggest the significance of a historical epistemology of the commodity for new approaches to the global history of capitalism. So first, to return to the coin, as literary theorists have long known, the notion of the commodity was in flux in early modern Britain, slipping, as Douglas Brewster has observed, between two different meanings. One is something like a convenience or a comfort, and another as an exchangeable goods or wares. So these are both from Shakespeare. The flux itself is less interesting, perhaps, than the way it reveals how the commodity as a way of knowing had emerged as a way of critiquing non-commercial cultural values, serving as a means to defamiliarize them to ironic effect. So we can see this poetic lensing effect of the commodity, for example, here in Henry IV, Part 1, and All's Well That Ends Well. The joke, or anyway, the play in these lines, so Falstaff to Hal and Paroles to Helena, comes out of the way they deploy commodity in its dynamic economic sense as a means to defamiliarize reputation on the one hand. So, I would to God thou and I knew where a commodity of good names were to be bought. And virginity, the commodity that will lose its gloss and line, on the other. By equating them with goods to be bought and sold, things that are vendable, in Perrault's words. So in Shakespeare, the use is reflexive, it's internal, it's poetic, a kind of auto-critique of the cultural valuation as part of what Raymond Williams might have called Britain's early modern structure of feeling. But with empire, the expansion of settler colonialism in the Americas, the trade to Africa, Asia, and the Middle East, the same process, the same sort of way of seeing turned outward as Europeans began to interact more directly with regimes of value other than their own and began to take and the commodity began to take on a more specific cross-cultural form. So let me give you an example of what I mean. In 1627, William Bradford, so then governor of Plymouth Colony in what is now southeastern Massachusetts, discovered that the beads made from the tubular heart of Buzikon Welks and the quahog clam Mercenaria mercenaria discovered that they were a commodity. According to Bradford, the discovery happened like this. So these, by the way, are the shells, obviously. On the left is the whelk, and then in the middle is a mercenaria mercenaria bead, the purple one on the right. So according to Bradford, the discovery happened like this. Bradford had seen some of the beads before on some, quote, sachems and special persons that wore a little bit of it for ornament, but had not known what they were. So here's actually 18th century Mohawk leader Joseph Brant, draped in similar beads to give you an idea of what he was seeing. Well, this is obviously 100 years or 150 years later. So in the fall of 1627, Isaac de Rezier, an official dispatched the year before by the Dutch West India Company, came to Plymouth in part in order to inform him of the beads' potential. So this is the living museum of Plymouth today. You can see on the horizon the container ship, perhaps a harbinger of things to come. The most interesting consequence of Razier's visit, Bradford recalled, was a, quote, entrance into the trade of wampum peak. This entrance took the form of a sales pitch in which Razier's tried to convince Bradford that the beads, which he had brought with him, were a commodity. Razier's, in effect, asked Bradford to apply the same creative lens Shakespeare deployed on reputation in Henry IV, Part 1, to see something of evident cultural value in terms of its commercial value. The pitch had two parts. Both were attempts to get Bradford to see the beads differently, and both crucial for understanding the development of the commodity. First, Razier's told Bradford that the beads were vendable, emphasizing how incredibly attractive they were in the furs trade with the powerful Five Nations of the Iroquois at the Dutch settlement at Fort Orange, modern-day Albany, New York. And second, Razier's attempted to convince Bradford how attractive the beads would be to the Algonquin-speaking peoples along the Kennebec River, hundreds of miles to the northeast. This was a difficult sell, but Razier's was persuasive. He succeeded in offloading 50 pounds sterling worth of the beads, which indeed grew, in Bradford's formulation, to be a commodity. As soon as coastal peoples began trading the beads into the Algonquin interior, English trade transformed because the shells had been confirmed as a commodity vendable across cultural lines, making it seem as if the shells had value inherent in themselves, independent of local cultural variables. Paradoxically, this meant that when it came to establishing the beads' commercial value, the discrete cultural practices that made the beads valuable in any one place were irrelevant, perhaps even misleading. Indeed, the colonists themselves, who went into the shell trade in a massive way, at one Iroquoian site alone, archaeologists have uncovered 250,000 of the beads. They constantly mistook the source of the value. referring to wampum as the beads came to be called as the money of the Native American Northeast, when their primary purpose, in fact, was as a means of ritual interregional communication. In fact, it might be more accurate, in light of anthropologist Keith Hart's recent work on money as fundamentally a medium of global communication, to call money the wampum of the 21st century. But mistaking wampum for money was a feature, not a bug, of the commodity as a way of knowing. Cultural particularities only obscured the value that arose in places in between. Simultaneously, though, as we see in this quote from Bradford's memoirs, Native Americans soon realized what the significance of their transplanted neighbors' new way of understanding the bead's value was, going into manufacturing for themselves and driving hard bargains for guns, powder, and shot that Bradford resented. They played on the significance of the beads as a commodity, in Bradford's sense, and within a few years, as money as well, after the Dutch and English made wampum a legal tender. And that should alert us to another aspect of the recognitions at play here, those from the perspective of people encountering Europeans. To the Narragansetts, in this quote, the commodity as a way of knowing presented itself as a specifically European cultural practice, which could be exploited in turn. This is all to suggest, then, that commodification has a history where, in the process of reducing a commodity as a complex social object to a good with a price, begins not in the act of stripping qualities, leaving only quantities, but in a new way of understanding how particular items moved in cross-cultural exchange, one that centered their value rather than within particular cultures and the places between them. So that brings us to part two, bringing it all back home, the moral economy of the commodity as a way of knowing. The commodity as a way of understanding goods eventually came back. Doing critical work in the reformation of English political economy of the dawn of the 18th century, in the course of this work, the commodity as a way of knowing transformed, taking on what Lorraine Dasein has referred to as a moral economy of knowledge. This transformative tension, I think, is especially clear when authors discussed not what a commodity was, but what it was not, tweaking the commodity's relatively new definition as an object in trade. Take, for instance, this very famous passage from Locke in 1695. Here Locke is arguing that silver, valued by weight and fineness, was naturally money, which might be and has been seen as a primary instance of the commodification of money, because Locke's definition had the effect of stripping traditional elements of the sovereign prerogative around money by reducing it to an institution in effect as an object with a price, establishing it as equivalent with the commodity value of fine silver in international trade. And yet, as we see here, for Locke, one of the key elements of silver as money was that it was not a commodity, or at the very least, not only a commodity like other metals. It could not be strictly a commodity, I would suggest, because its value was not located in the spaces in between. Silver, from stamped shims to milled coins, had been money in Britain for centuries. Here's some examples. A history that Locke did not disavow. Rather, he used the recognition of the value of silver had elsewhere to assign it a special status. We might think of this as a moment where the commodity became moralized. Silver, in Locke's account, is the money of the world and not merely a commodity, because its value arises not from nature itself, but from human nature. Inasmuch as it is the measure of value for the entire trading world, it is a marker of human rationality itself. The implication was that those who felt differently were somewhat less than fully reasonable and perhaps less than fully human. I want to suggest the effect was to imbue the commodity as a way of knowing with this moral economy, a basis for evaluation of alternative epistemologies and ways of knowing goods in trade, because it is seen to be the only good and correct way to view them. And more significantly to the history of capitalism, it made the commodity as a way of knowing seem to be the only rational basis for a political economy. This moral economy has been especially significant to me because of the difficulty of explaining the cultural logic of British imperial administrators at the end of the Seven-Year War. So I work on the revolutionary period in America often, and the transformation of money during that period. So when confronted for the first time with a truly global empire, straddling three continents from Boston to Bengal, these administrators attempted to establish the fiscal basis for that empire. The institutions that would ensure profits made at one end of the earth would be commensurable with profits made at the other. Their choices in doing so in the 1760s and 70s were unambiguously disastrous. They caused, at the very least, exacerbated a famine that led to the death or migration of some 10 million people in North India and to the imposition of taxes paid in silver that, in the final estimation, were impossible to pay in the American Revolution. But in my recent work, I've attempted to explain these decisions functionally to show how the decision to form an empire around a silver standard was not simply a continuity of Locke's analysis, but also a reasoned response to what I and my co-authors described as China's early modern global monetary hegemony that made silver valued by weight and fineness the money of the world. But that analysis, while useful as an explanation of much of the available evidence, does not account for something I have found harder to explain. Not simply the sense of necessity surrounding the imperial fiscal system, but the evident distaste, verging on disgust, imperial administrators had for alternatives. The monetary component of the system of imperial reform forwarded by George Grenville's administration, for instance, had its roots in a March 1764 memo authored by the Earl of Hillsborough for King George III. The memo, while it was arguably part of the process of imperial reform, made no mention of the larger picture of India, of China, of the world Britain was trying to reduce to a system. Rather, Hillsborough accused the Americans, rather bizarrely, with fraud. For Hillsborough, the American monetary system was not simply undesirable, it was strange and deceitful, its nature founded in fraud and injustice. At the same time, however, this fraud was based on a misunderstanding on the part of the Americans regarding the nature of money, which we can sort of see here. That American money was not simply he said that the Americans were wrong because they believed that money was simply a measure. And here we see a direct echo of Locke's language. While money was not simply a measure, it was also an equivalent, which is to say, as Hillsborough went on to explain, money must be the equivalent of gold or silver or other valuable commodities. The measure argument was a reference to the intellectual foundation of American bills of credit, which were organized ultimately around a non-commodity concept of money, a concept I'd be happy to go into further in our discussion. However, as you can see, Hillsborough jumps immediately from this intellectual assault to a kind of exasperation with the idea that Americans would designate paper as something of universal intrinsic value. From one perspective, this makes very little sense. If Americans think of money as something other than an equivalent, then why would they be concerned with the physical material value of their bills? And also, isn't Hillsborough demonstrating a remarkable ignorance of his own monetary system, which, as we know, was proliferating paper monies of various sorts? So bank bills, navy bills, army bills, inland bills of exchange, bills of exchequer at the exact same time. But if we consider the commodity as a way of knowing, and one that had acquired a morality in the century since William Bradford had discovered that wampum was a commodity, it makes sense. Hillsborough returns repeatedly, as economic historians have done ever since, to the idea of money, American money as paper, because he has difficulty seeing an object in trade as anything other than a commodity. He has been made aware of the American intellectual, institutional, practical justifications of their monetary practices over 2 months of hearings, but insists on stripping that away, as if the true worth of America's paper money can only ultimately reside in its intrinsic commodity value, founded in paper's dubious cross-cultural vendability as an object in trade. Anything else, he observes, would be absurd, fraudulent, he might have added, immoral, because it did not partake in the universal way of knowing objects as commodities in the world. So in closing, when people think of the global history of capitalism, they tend to think of a diffusion story. That's true whether we consider capitalism as a world system, like the late Emanuel Wallerstein, or as a congeries of practices most closely directed with wage labor. Both views, though, miss the significance of encounters with non-European polities and cultures in the construction of capitalism's basic categories, like the commodity, and their subsequent projection on the world. What Peter has suggested calling capitalism's systolic-diastolic process after the pumping motion of the heart. What I would like to propose here, as we reconsider the divergence debates, is that the history of early modern capitalism is instead, in large measure, an infusion story. Capitalism considered institutionally and intellectually in terms of its basic categories and habits of mind, its truth claims, its epistemology, its paradoxical claim to be both universal and universalizing, was the product of encounters with the world that were moralized, systematized, and turned against the other itself. And at the core of that story and the global history of capitalism is a history of the commodity as a way of knowing, centered in the spaces in between. Thank you.